Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
My guest this week is probably still best known for co-creating Chappelle's Show. He's also a deeply hilarious stand-up comedian in his own right.
So it's my turn, and President Obama's here, First Lady Obama's there, and I walk in with the president, I go, hey, man, which I'm pretty sure you're not supposed to call him. But it was better than like, hey, man, is this your girl? What up, ma? So I go, hey man, my name's Neil Brennan and I created Chappelle's Show with Dave Chappelle. And he goes, oh man, we love that show. In fact, that's got to be considered one of the greatest shows of all time. What are you gonna say? I gotta say, felt pretty good. Like if he'd wanted a hand job, I would have given it to him. So he goes, Michelle, this guy created Chappelle's Show with Dave Chappelle. So Michelle comes over and goes, we were so upset when it went off the air. And I go, how do you think I felt?
This is The Last Laugh. I'm Matt Wilstein from The Daily Beast, and that was Neil Brennan talking about the time he met Barack and Michelle Obama from his 2012 Comedy Central half hour. In the 10 years since that special came out, Neil has put out 2 hours on Netflix, 2017's Three Mics, and his latest called Blocks, which just premiered on the service last week. In the new special, Neil gets more personal than ever before about the many ways in which he feels like he doesn't fit into regular society. He's not married, doesn't have kids, doesn't drink or do drugs, and doesn't even particularly love his dog. And after all these years doing stand-up, he's still seen as a writer who has helped much more famous comedians become superstars, which means he's still getting unfairly compared to Dave Chappelle. We get into all of it in this episode, including what it's been like to watch his oldest friend in comedy become a villain to many for his obsession with making the trans community a punchline. His thoughts on that just might surprise you. All right, let's go to that conversation now. Here's me with Neil Brennan. Yeah, I would love to just jump right into your new Netflix special, Blocks, which I got to see last night and really, really enjoyed. I realized it used to be called Unacceptable when it was a live show, and now it's Blocks on Netflix. And I think it's a reference to the very unique backdrop that you have. Can you explain what that is for people who maybe haven't seen it yet and how it kind of came to be?
Yeah, so I basically had a show written and sent it to a friend of mine who's an artist and said, like, can you make a backdrop? And she sent it back to me. She sent me like a big crate of blocks that are symbolic of the things that are on the jokes. It's almost like a set list behind me. It's kind of a cheat.
you can look back at it and reference if you forget where you are.
You'd be shocked how forgetful I can get. So it's like basically it serves as a backdrop, and they're fairly large blocks. So it's and they're colorful, so they look like something.
Yeah. I mean, I think from what I took away from it, the basic premise of the show is that you feel like you don't fit in society in some way. And there's a refrain throughout where you say, you know, something is wrong with me. And that becomes something that you kind of are saying as an aside at the beginning and then gets more meaningful towards the end. How did you kind of arrive at that as the theme of what you wanted to talk about in this show?
Well, that was when I was looking at the jokes and was sort of, after I'd written them all, like I'd written them just sort of naturally like a stand-up. And then once I saw them all together, I was like, what am I getting at? And what I was getting at is that I was like, oh, I'm very defensive about what I'm like. And I also feel like a outlier in in, or like a loner or isolated in like five different categories, if not more, you know, five that I talk about. So that's sort of the, and it was called Unacceptable when I did it in New York last year. So that's the basic premise, is like, I feel alienated and I'm just trying to talk about it. And also what alienation does to you. Like, I'm defensive about these things only insofar as most people are not like this. You know, most people are married. By the time they're my age, they are married. They have kids. Most people drink. Most people smoke weed. Most people eat meat. Most people, like, fit into categories simpler and more comfortably than I do. It starts to eat away at you because you go, like, what is wrong with me that I don't do anything normally? You know what TV show made me really wary of having kids? You guys ever see that show, The Nightly News? It's, all right, climate change is a nightmare. We're already double what Earth's population should be. Plus, I can't remember this much anger or division in my entire life. To me, having a kid right now would be like being in a house party. It's packed with people, you can't move, roof's on fire, basement's flooding, cops are coming to arrest everybody, and you look at your friend and you're like, we should invite Brian.
Yeah, I mean, do you feel like those are all conscious decisions that you made or just sort of who you are?
Yeah, I do. I came to them all naturally. You know, like I came to not getting married naturally. I didn't go like, I'm going to buck the system. I just didn't find anybody I wanted to marry. I never wanted to have kids. Like weed does not feel good to me. Alcohol is a trigger for me. I'm not a good liberal. My relationship to my dog, he may make a cameo later, is sort of like, I'd say, I like him.
Yeah. He's not your best friend.
He's not my best friend. Nope. Not my best friend. I prefer a human best friend who can speak English. Even my career is fucking odd. You know, that's like what the last 7 or 8 minutes is about. It's like, I was going to do a joke that I ended up cutting, but in the show where I was like, even tonight at this show, a lot of you were like, hey, you want to go see this comedian? He's a writer, you know? Yeah. I would argue, Matt, that even like the press has a hard time categorizing me, where they're like, are you still doing stand-up? Yeah, dude, it's been 15 years. Do you mind? You're like, but aren't you more? No, I'm a comedian who can write.
You also have what turned out to be a pretty prescient bit about Kanye West in the show. Although I guess, you know, he's been struggling for a while. So you didn't exactly see the future, but it was before this most recent meltdown.
Oh, you know who's a liberal conundrum as a person? Kanye. Yeah, because when Kanye first started, he said George Bush doesn't care about black people, and conservatives were like, he needs to shut the fuck up, and liberals were like, no, he's an artist, let him speak. And then he started saying how much he liked Trump, and liberals were like, you know what, he doesn't need to shut the fuck up. People are at this point are just exhausted by Kanye. People are like, that guy's fucking crazy. Yeah, no kidding. He's a rapper. Since when do you rely on rappers for their emotional stability? Like, what's your argument? Like, back in my day, there was a guy named Flavor Flav. And he'd walk around and say, yeah, boy, you know what time it is. And we did know what time it was. He had a fucking giant clock on his chest.
So how do you think about him now? Do you feel like
Kanye, the first time Kanye was on TV was on Chappelle's show. So I've known him since before his first album came out.
Yeah.
Yeah, and like, I really like that guy. In my heart and in his heart. I think that's what has happened to Kanye is kind of, as usual, a microcosm of what has happened to a lot of people, which is I said the other day that Kanye has algorithm personality disorder, where he started out just like being on the internet and curious about things. And I think he didn't want to get pigeonholed or boxed in as he wanted more for himself than the boilerplate black male identity, right? He wanted to be punk rock. He wanted freedom. the algorithm just pushed him further and further and further and further and further to the right. I mean, the algorithm meaning probably the literal YouTube algorithm, but also just like where it goes. Like once you start going in that direction, it starts off with both political parties are the same. And then you just get a little more, it's a little more, it's a slow drip to anti-Semitism, paranoia, and kind of weird, just it's kind of schizophrenia politically. And then you add $1 billion to it and a ton of talent, and no one can say anything to him. He cannot be stopped. Can't be stopped. Blow dart is the only way to stop him at this point.
Do you feel like when you first met him, you said before his first album came out, was it like a totally different person? Was he, because he didn't have that power and that fame?
He was always, that story that Dave tells about My Life is Dope and I Do Dope Shit, that's the first day he did the show. And he came to editing and we were showing him sketches and he was just a regular, I mean, he was bombastic, but he was, the thing about Kanye, even now, I know people that are working with him like 3 weeks ago. He's a kind guy. He's not a puncher. He's not malevolent. He's not a, you know what I mean? Like again, it seems impossible to say this, but he, in my experience, I spent time with him, I don't know, 4 years ago or something, but he's just, I don't know. When I see him, I see the old Kanye, but all the stuff he's doing is just reprehensible and incredibly, you know, dangerous and sad. There's no history. I mean, that's there. People don't remember people. I believe the reason like the last 6 weeks have been so bad for Democrats is because people forget that abortion got overturned.
Yeah, the attention
spans. People's memories are so short.
I know.
They don't remember the Holocaust. It's just all a weird, hazy stream of stuff flying past us.
Yeah, I mean, if they don't remember Roe v. Wade getting overturned, they definitely don't remember the Holocaust.
Yes.
I do wonder, since you've spoken a lot about, you know, mental health issues and you talk about it in this show, do you worry about people sort of conflating his anti-Semitism with mental illness, you know?
Well, I mean, I think, again, you know, this is a tricky one because people say he's not mentally ill. His mental illness has nothing to do with anti-Semitism. Or I'm sorry, his anti-Semitism has nothing to do with mental illness. It implies that Hitler wasn't mentally ill. It implies that, like, virulent anti-Semitism or racism or bigotry isn't a form of mental illness, which I kind of think it is. It's not, you're not dealing with facts. It's all paranoia. Somebody had a great tweet the other day, which is like, I think it was a black woman tweeted this idea that Jews are controlling the world. Jews didn't overturn Roe v. Wade. Jews had nothing to do with it. They're not trying to inflict their lifestyle on Iran or America or any, you know, Israel's a liberal society.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's hard, I think, for, I guess you still see the old Kanye, but it's hard for, I think, most people to see that at this point.
Make no mistake, I'm not defending him at all.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that all bigotry is a form of mental illness. It's mild, but I don't think I can look at, you know, I don't think that you come to it logically.
You talk in the special about how you don't really drink or do recreational drugs, but then I did hear you talking, I think, on The Daily Show about how Will Smith turned you on to ayahuasca.
He sure did.
So is that the one drug that you've been drawn to?
Well, again, ayahuasca is not a recreational drug, is the thing. It is technically an entheogen. I'm so deep into it that you may notice that I say recreation or drugs. I changed it. Recreational drugs don't work on me. So ayahuasca is not recreational because it's completely unpredictable. So you can't be like, we're all going to hang out. It's not a party.
Yeah, it's not.
It's more akin to like surgery. I'm a zealot is what I'm trying to tell you, Matt.
Yeah. So how did, it doesn't seem like the ayahuasca seems to have solved Will Smith's anger problems. But What do you feel like it's done for you?
It's helped me with depression a lot. And obviously I have pretty treatment resistant depression. Also why I say I was an atheist. I was an atheist before I did ayahuasca. And then I think the third time I did it, I was like, oh, I'm in the presence of God. Okay. And I'm no longer an atheist. So those are two pretty big ones. No longer an atheist and believe in God. And, I'm going to say, I mean, it's done a lot of things, but one of them would also be, I think it's maybe less misogynistic generally.
Mm-hmm. How so?
Because it is a feminine spirit. It presents as a feminine spirit. And the ceremonies I've done with women, I've been shown so much kindness and nurturing that it's like, I gotta be less misogynist. I mean, you know what I mean? Like just generally speaking, like the walking around American male misogyny. I mean, just or male misogyny, like just the basic like cats and dogs, men and women, you know, like gamesmanship or whatever, or general like basic tension. I believe it's reduced in me.
In terms of the Will Smith aspect of it, you have a joke about the slap in your special in the closer in reference to Chris Rock. You know, he still hasn't really spoken much about it. Is that something that
you... Let me tell you what he thinks, Matt.
Yeah,
I'm kidding.
No. what was your reaction to all of that? And then there was sort of like the, does this mean that all comedians are under threat? Or do you think that was just sort of an isolated incident? Obviously, Chappelle got attacked. Someone tried to attack him as well. And then I just talked to Chris Redd, who got punched out in front of the...
Yeah, how is Chris?
He's good.
Do we know why somebody punched him?
We don't know why. I talked to him just yesterday, actually, and then it'll be another episode of this podcast. But yeah, he did have an ice
pack on his eye the whole time?
No, he's still a little swollen with some cuts, but yeah,
so
he's
what?
But yeah, he has no idea, and the guy ran off and they didn't get him.
So odd. I don't believe that comedians are under attack. I believe that in some ways some of this is just discourse, meaning comedy's never been more popular. It's kind of the only, I know 15 comedians that are doing arenas, so I don't see how that's an attack. I see it as somewhat of a form of, Dave is more a form, I mean, I think the Chris and Will thing is just an incredibly odd moment.
Yeah.
I think
it really was.
I mean, yeah. The Dave thing at the Hollywood Bowl, I think is just a crazy person. In some ways, it's just stage diving. But the comedians, because of, you know, my theory that because the media has failed, the clergy has failed, and corporations have failed, comedians have had to, like, fill the void. Or the void has been filled for people by comedians. So so now we have all this importance that we didn't really have 30 years ago.
Do you think that's a good thing or a bad thing?
I think it's probably better than, I don't know. I think it's mixed, honestly. I think it's like, it's the clergy turns out we're sleeping with, having sex with kids. So that would go for all religions, and not all religions were having sex with kids, but a lot of religions were corrupt, and certainly the leadership. The media thing, I think the media has failed in a lot of ways, but in some ways that are just human and understandable. And in terms of like, and there's very little community left. So that in terms of community leaders, I think in some ways having comedians in charge, I think having George Carlin in charge, I think in some ways comedy was like a subculture, counterculture, like Carlin and Pryor and Hicks and guys like that. And then I think in some ways there were, I mean, I will say for those three in particular, there was a heavy morality. You know, did they have the most moral lives? No.
Probably not, yeah.
Not yeah. So I think Hicks was actually probably more moral than Carlin and Pryor, but just empirically. But so I think it's a mixed bag. I think you can't lionize people. You just have to look up to ideals. You can't look up to people, because people are just, like I used to say all the time, like the best we can get morally is like a C+, the best grade. So looking up to people is like, it never ends well, especially now that we have like so much more transparency. So, you know, that Martin Luther King was cheated on his wife, and Gandhi was a racist, and even the greatest among us are like, good, okay, C+, B+.
I think the other part of comedians being the sort of moral leaders in some way is that people take what they're joking about very literally and seriously, and sort of, I've talked to other comics who aren't thrilled about that idea that people sort of take everything you're saying on stage as gospel, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, and I see people play both sides of it, because I think there are people that want to believe that what they're saying is a form of preaching, and then as soon as people hold them to a standard, look, nobody wants to be held to a standard on earth. Nobody in a relationship, nobody at work, nobody at, you know what I mean? Like nobody in terms of a moral barometer. It's everybody just wants to live in anonymity, but also be famous. Whoops.
So speaking of famous, getting back to your special, you have this incredible story in your, that's really sort of the beginning of your closer, about this party at Ted Sarandos's house.
A great man.
And it's basically every massive comedian in one room. Do you really don't feel like you fit in with that crowd, with those people?
I will say that I am the, you know, the lowest status person of that high status group. Or I was the, you know, on terms of the invite list, there's a lot of places between me and Ellen and Eddie. But I could argue the opposite, which is like, but I still got invited. So like it's, and somebody has to be the least successful person there. So literally somebody has to be. I definitely am aware of like the differences between me and the people at the party. But at the same time, you know, I could argue that like I've written for a lot of them, so I must be fairly good. And I have now I have about 3 hours of material on Netflix at this point. So
yeah,
not bad. You know?
Yeah. I mean, you have sort of done a lot of this behind the scenes work, whether it's directing or producing other comic specials or writing for them. I mean, some of the names of people that you've either directed or produced are Chris Rock, Ellen DeGeneres, Seth Meyers, Michelle Wolf, you know, obviously co-creator of Chappelle's Show. So do you feel like, you were saying before, you feel like the press doesn't know where to put you, or people don't know how to think about you. Has a lot of it been sort of trying to break out of that behind the scenes thing and put yourself out there in a way that you maybe weren't at the beginning of your career?
Well, yeah, more or less. I spent the first 15 years being a writer, first 10 years, 15, 10, 15. And then the last 15 I was a writer director, and then I became a comedian. So I understand the difficulty. I think if I had, you know, it's like Louis and Tina and Larry David were like similar, and then they just had, they made TV shows that were explosive. So, and then it sort of left all that in the dust. So they're writing in the dust. I haven't done a TV show, so I don't have that. I haven't been able to I haven't been able to clear people's memory of the other stuff I've done.
Is that something that you've tried to do, that you want to do, or are you?
I've done it. I've done pilots, didn't get picked up. The Mark Twain stuff, I think they kept some of it. The Dave thing, like we both talk about, like having a TV show is just incredibly taxing. And so there are times where I want to have a TV show, but I don't want to work quite that hard. So I understand that it is hard to sort of place me. I think I get compared to, it's hard to be compared to Dave for anyone. I don't never see us as like comparable. Do you know what I mean? Like, I guess we're similar writing wise, but I think I get compared in a way. Like, people don't compare Larry to Jerry Seinfeld.
Yeah, they just feel like they're kind of did two different things. Yeah.
Yeah, like, or Louis C.K. to Chris, or, you know what I mean? Like, so again, I'm not complaining. It's just one of those things. I think hopefully at a certain point, maybe now, maybe in a week or two, people will go like, oh, this dude's good comedian.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think you have a line in your special where you say something like, why can't I just do regular stand-up? Because you do have sort of, you had the three mic special, which played with the form. And this one, which, you know, is for the most part, a regular stand-up show. You do have some props, as you mentioned. But it plays
with the form. Yeah, so it plays with the form. Yeah.
So I find both of those specials to be just really innovative and different and good for that reason. I also felt like I really felt your director, Derek Delgadio's influence, especially at the end and the sort of final magic trick of sorts that ends the special. I became kind of obsessed with him and his show in and of itself. Was that how you connected with him originally, or how did you...
I went to Derek's show, picked my card was comedian, and then he was going around at the end and he said, you're a very good comedian. I was like, oh. So that was cute. So I hung out afterward and we struck up a friendship, I guess probably 4 or 5 years ago at this point. And he was involved in this show from a very early stage and was helpful. Generally, I'd rather keep it vague for the whole thing, but he was very involved. And there aren't many people who do shows like this, so it was very cool to have one of the 6 or 7 people that do kind of these shows.
I imagine that the two of you that could relate to each other as that sort of hard to define artist. I know I talked to him about how he doesn't really feel like a magician in the traditional sense.
I hate calling him a magician. Do you know what I mean? Like, it doesn't, even illusionist is like, no.
Yeah. It's really something else.
But artist is like, gives me the douche chill. So,
yeah.
it's, we're in a tough spot.
The directing of comedy specials is something that you've done that I think people don't really understand what it entails. And it's probably different for different people, but is that something that, you know, that you've enjoyed doing for other people?
Yeah. I mean, it's generally friends. Seth and Michelle is clearly, Seth, I've been friends with, I guess we're almost 20 years now. And then Ellen and Chris, well, Chris I'm friends with, I just like helping. I like comedy. Like, in some ways, whenever I watch people's specials, I'm like, why didn't they show me this before they shot it? Cause I'll think of like 3 tags for them. And I'll just be like, just send me your act. I want to help.
I feel like I've heard a lot of comedians talk about you as the tag generator that they turn
to.
Yeah,
I just like it. I just like it. Like, I like comedy. I wish there was more of that spirit.
Of sort of sharing and generosity?
Yeah, just generally. Because it's, yeah, like the spirit of like, hey, man, I watched your thing, and like all of us helping each other like Amish people.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I love about Mike Birbiglia's podcast now, is that's basically what he's doing, is inviting other comedians on to help add tags to each other's bits.
Yeah, for sure. It kind of feels like the point, or one of the points. It could be the point if you want to be that way.
Coming up, Neil looks back at the origins of his creative partnership with Dave Chappelle and weighs in on the latest controversies surrounding his very famous friend.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
This episode of The Last Laugh is brought to you by Vanderpump Villa, a new reality show starring Lisa Vanderpump, now streaming only on Hulu. Join Lisa and her hand-selected staff at Chateau Rosabelle, a glamorous estate in the French countryside. Meet the elite staff as they work, live, and play together 24/7 while dealing with rivalry, romance, and misadventures. As they try to provide once-in-a-lifetime experiences for their guests, the staff will need to meet Lisa's high standards. Not everybody has what it takes. Watch new episodes of Vanderpump Villa every Monday, now on Hulu. If you're enjoying this episode and want to hear more, please make sure you are following The Last Laugh wherever you get your podcasts. By subscribing to The Last Laugh, you can listen to my conversations with other stand-up comedians like Hasan Minhaj, Roy Wood Jr., Mike Birbiglia, and more, along with everything else from our free archive. And you'll be the first to hear new episodes when they drop every Tuesday. And while you're at it, please leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. Let us know how much you love the show and who you want to hear next. Now, back to Neil Brennan. You mentioned the Mark Twain Prize ceremony for Dave, which I really enjoyed watching and seeing you on. And you mentioned in that one the story behind writing Half-Baked, which as someone who was 14 when that movie came out, was very important to me. What was that? Can you briefly, share that story of how you ended up, connecting with him for that?
The slightly longer version. I mean, me and Dave were friends, started being friends when we were 18. So almost 17, 18 in New York. He was a comic. I was going to NYU film school and working the door. And we were the only kind of people our age. And so we hit it off and just a lot of similarities and ethos and comedy spirit, whatever. I end up moving to LA, getting some writing jobs. He actually helped me. He got me a flight out here when I was 20. Cause he was doing like Robin Hood Men in Tights, and I would come out here and we'd go to Arsenio and I went to the set of Robin Hood and had lunch with him and Mel Brooks and like, you know, Dave was really generous with that. And then I was writing for like Nickelodeon and I'd written a script that didn't go anywhere, but I had a meeting with this guy, Bob Simons, and I was super funny in the meeting. And then like a week later, Dave had a meeting there and he was like, yeah, I'm writing a weed movie. We'd gone to see Trainspotting and he was like, you could do a weed one of those. And I was like, and I literally was like, yeah, just like regular conversation. And then he had that meeting with Bob and he was like, yeah, I'm writing a, Bob goes, you have any ideas for movies? And Dave's like, yeah, what if we did like a train spotting for weed? And Bob was like, oh yeah, that's a good idea. And Dave's like, yeah, I'm working on it with my friend. And they go, who's your friend? And he's like, you've never heard of him. And they were like, no, seriously, who's your friend? And he goes, Neil Brennan. And they go, he was just here. So then they called me like, are you doing a weed movie with Dave? And I was like, yeah. And then we had 30 days to outline it. They just said, when can you do it? And I was like, never written anything. So I was like, 30 days time. That seemed
which
like the right
fast
amount. Yeah, at least for it. Yeah, so... So then we just waited until the day before the pitch and spent the day at the Mondrian Hotel outlining it. We both read this book, The Writer's Journey by Christopher Vogler. It's really helpful with structure and came up with the basic building blocks of the movie, pitched it the next day. And that was like in March or something, maybe February of 1997. And then we're shooting in July. We wrote it. I mean, it's crazy. So I wouldn't say the rest is history, but the rest is known.
The movie, I love that movie. I know it wasn't a huge box office hit, although it found a lot of success later.
Putting it kindly, yeah.
But it did, I'm sure, in some way lead to Chappelle's Show and the two of you continuing to work together.
It led to Chappelle's Show in that we both were sort of felt scarred by it. So when we ended up doing Chappelle's Show, we were absolute control freaks about every element of the show.
What were those initial conversations like in terms of what you wanted it to be, how you wanted it to be different than other sketch shows, or what you sort of, what the mission of it was?
We talked a lot about, like, we always mentioned the word frequency when we're writing the pilot. When we wrote the pilot, we were listening to, like, we're watching at this point on VHS, Lauryn Hill's Unplugged. And there was such a, like, keening cry from Lauryn, and being able to capture a bit of that, capture a bit of, like, a primal scream about, certainly about race, and just wanting it to be good, wanting it to be, like, really good, intelligent sketches with a point. And not just like, I mean, we did a lot of boob sketches too. So, like, don't get me wrong, we were 28.
Do you feel like there is a, do you feel like there's a single sketch that in your mind that really captures sort of the ideal version of what you wanted the show to be?
Yeah. It's funny. Like, the, in the intervening years since the show, we both came to the same conclusion about what our favorite sketch was, which is, it's called, Jury Selection, where Dave is explaining why he couldn't be on most of the juries of famous trials of black dudes. And it, the way it came about was, like, so clutch, where we had, we were out of sketches, and we, and I read this Michael Jackson Vanity Fair, like the first really damning Michael Jackson article about the molestation stuff. And I was like, here you go, here, check out your boy. And then he just started, like, defending, and we both got the look in our eyes like,
this is something.
This is the, yeah, here we go. So that, Blind White Supremacist, Rick James, Prince, yeah, the usual suspects. But that one is, like,
that's sort of more, maybe a more underrated one.
Yeah, it's just, you wouldn't, and he's just really funny. He's incredibly funny in it. There's good written jokes. He's very, like, energetic, considering the fact that he's sitting there, he pees on somebody. It's just, you know, it's got everything you want.
Are you aware of the charges that Michael Jackson is currently facing?
Yes, sir. And for the record, these charges hurt me the most.
So he's guilty.
Look, man, look, Michael Jackson has many faces. None of them look guilty to me. You gotta look in the eyes, not the noses.
He's been accused of this more than once.
So, some people say the cucumbers taste better pickled.
What?
Huh?
What? Huh?
You've sort of joked in the past about how his decision to walk away from the show maybe wasn't the best for you. But how did you feel about it then versus, you know, so many years later?
I've never liked it. Didn't like it then. Don't like it now. I didn't like it then, and my mind hasn't really changed. It's just
Because of all the money left on the table, or because of what you guys were doing?
Yeah,
or?
It was more, I like doing it. Again, I'm really happy with what my life has become. But I didn't, it's just a painful time. The whole middle of 2004 to middle of 2005 is just, I don't think it'll ever be worse for me.
And what made it so bad?
You know, the from negotiating money, you know, like a triangle of me and Dave in Comedy Central. And after a negotiation, having to work with in a sort of hot, challenging environment,
okay,
we'll say. Yeah, it's just a challenging environment. And yeah, it was just a very hard time to work.
Yeah, I remember, you know, when he finally talked about sort of why he decided to move to walk away, there was the concern about people laughing for the wrong reasons. And then I saw in your special, you have a joke about how, you know, one of your jokes, if told in a different context, could kill at a Klan rally. And the idea that intentions don't necessarily matter. So was that something that you could relate to him about, or a concern that you shared?
For sure. Absolutely. Yeah, of course. Like, I think that the anecdote I tell is it was after the first season. So it was 2 years before he walked, but we were somewhere, we're like in Phoenix or something, and a guy came up at a club and was with like sort of a dusty white dude and was like, I like that sketch where the guy leaves his wife because she's a lover. But he said it and it was just like, fuck. And that's a thing that I'm aware of. It's funny when you do racial jokes as a, I think it's pretty clear whose side I'm on morally. I believe in racial justice, et cetera, et cetera. I teach CRT to my dog. I'm kidding. But you can't control what people hear. They also think it's racist, one of those things where people think they want to do. It's like Chris Rock says that the N-word is like nitroglycerin. But even any kind of racial joke is nitroglycerin. If you don't know what you're doing, you're going to burn yourself. You're going to burn the people around you. It's going to be highly damaging. So I would argue that I know what I'm doing, but even I burn myself and burn other people. So it's loaded, doesn't even get at it.
Well, the whole idea that your intentions as a comedian don't necessarily matter compared to how people receive it, I mean, could obviously be applied to everything that Chappelle has been dealing with in the past, couple of years as well. You reference it in your special when you start talking about trans issues. You say, you imagine someone in the audience say, don't go out like your boy. And so I'm wondering what it's been like for you to watch him turn into sort of a comedy villain to a lot of people in around this issue.
Look, my take on all that stuff is just, it's very, the size that Dave has grown into as a figure in American life is so funny to me. I can't even, it's like, it's so absurd as like someone, it's like a guy I was, it's like if you're, I'm, it's so crazy. It's all so crazy from Chappelle show to now. It's all so crazy. I don't think I could ever express. It's like if you're, it's like I call him like my cellmate or something. You know what I mean? It's like a guy I was locked in a room with for years. And then he just becomes this towering figure. And deservedly so, by the way, in terms of intelligence and like talent. Like deservedly so, you just don't think it would ever get that big just because like, what? That's absurd, So it's like, I feel like I was friends with New Amsterdam and now he's Manhattan. You know what I mean? Like when I spent all my time, the lion's share of my time, I still text and see him and all that stuff, but like he's got kids and whatever. Yeah, like the size to which he's grown as a cultural icon is it's just funny. I can't explain it.
Yeah. But at the same time,
imagine your best friend from college.
Yeah, as the most famous person.
The guy that you would like sleep. Yeah, like the guy that you would just like, huh? What? Like I have like these tiny life memories with him. And then anytime I pick up my phone, it's like, Dave's. Do you hear what Dave did? So it's just hilarious to me.
It's interesting, just in your special, you do some jokes about the trans stuff, but I think you do it in a way that really does not make that community the punchline. And that's sort of the one of the criticisms that's been leveled against Dave. Do you feel like that criticism has been fair or just totally unjustified, or how do you think about sort of all the incoming that he's received over this stuff?
It looks stressful. That's when I look at what it's like dealing with all that stuff. It just looks like that's a level of stress I have no interest in, that I truly don't even think I can handle. And that's what that joke is. Like, don't go out like your boy. I'm not saying like, don't say what he said. I'm saying it like, don't get involved.
I mean, that's what's been a little baffling to me is his continued, going back to the well of that particular issue. It seems like it's become kind of an obsession in a way that just keeps bringing on more and more hate.
I guess it's very important to him. in a way that I don't quite understand.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it must also make you think about the fame aspect that we were talking about and how, you know, you're about being the sort of the least...
I should cherish being the least famous person.
Is there an upside, I guess?
Yeah, there's a huge upside. I've done 10 things you could really get me in trouble for.
But nobody cares.
And kind of like, I always think of like, if I get a big, you know, a big boost, there's a ton of blogs. I mean, what I mean? Like,
yeah, it's Trevor Noah or what happened with, you know, someone like Shane Gillis or these people who get the big jobs and then everyone digs through their stuff, or Kevin Hart.
It wouldn't be worth the hits quotient. Like at this point, you could write a piece about me and people go like, eh, nah, nah, nah. Yeah. whatever, Dave. Look at Dave, because that's where the hits are. So, or Chris or Will, whatever, any of these people, or Trevor, like you said. So there's a part of me that is very cognizant of that, like extremely.
So what I want to do with our little bit of time that we have left is our final segment called The First Laugh. So I'm going to run through some questions in a quicker format. Starting with going all the way back to your childhood, do you remember the first piece of comedy that made you laugh really hard as a kid growing up?
Steve Allen read the lyrics to Hot Stuff on The Tonight Show. And it made me laugh so hard, I didn't know what was happening to my body. Wow. And I'd never heard Hot Stuff. I was just like, I don't know what the hell.
You just
Hot
knew it
Stuff
was funny.
By Donna Summer. Yeah.
Wow. Do you remember the first time that you knew you were funny, that you could make other people laugh?
Yeah, I don't remember what I said, but I remember getting a laugh so big. I was probably 6 or 7. And I got a laugh so big that I was embarrassed and like walked away.
Do you not remember why?
I don't know. It was like, I did an impression of a priest, I think. One of our priests.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah.
Do you have a joke from early in your career, sort of the first joke that really worked that you could keep going back to, that you remember just being really, really happy with in terms of stand-up?
There was a joke that Chelsea Peretti, I remember really liking, which was that I did about how women get upset because they get so dressed up for a night out, and then if they get turned away from a club, they're just furious. And it's like, it's all based on their expectation. I was like, you know, but if you look at me, like clearly, like this joke isn't going well, but like I'm dressed for it. And I was like, if I was wearing clown makeup and a tuxedo, I'd be furious. So yeah, that's the one that comes to mind. Oh, ironically enough, I do an NRA joke in the special. And I called Dave when I wrote it, and I was like whenever, a couple of years ago, and I was like, hey, has anyone done this joke? And he goes, you pitched me that joke in 1993.
you're so plagiarizing yourself now.
No, yeah, but I knew I did. I just like never knew how to do it or whatever.
It was somewhere
and so
in
that
your
would
brain.
Be like, yeah. So when I was a youngster and I finally brought it back.
Christmas and welcome to the 2022 NRA Military Showdown. Let's go down to the field of battle, meet one of our NRA combatants. Sir, what's your name? What kind of weapon do you work with? And he's like, my name's Andy Baker, and I got an AR-15 wearing Kevlar head to toe. Andy, how confident are you, scale of 1 to 10? Fucking a million. We're going to check in with the military real quick, and they cut to one guy by himself in a bunker, and he's like, my name's Staff Sergeant Jeremiah Walker. And they're like, Jeremiah, what kind of weapon do you work with? And he's like, look, I don't know if this is fair, but I'm working with a drone. Yeah, it's equipped with 8 Hellfire missiles and a high-powered camera. As you can see on this monitor here, the NRA fellas are actually in just one big cluster. So we started, all right?
One credit on your resume that stood out to me that I didn't realize was you helped write on the 2011 White House Correspondents' Dinner for Seth, I imagine.
Yeah.
He's talked a lot about how, you know, he feels, some responsibility for putting Trump in office for that. So I wanted to ask, do you think about that at all in terms of that
I can't
night?
Sleep. I'm addicted to painkillers because of it. It was just a fun night. It was great because, like, it was Seth's first big thing. Like, it was kind of his, like, coming out party, so to speak. The Trumpness of it, I mean, he'd already explored running for president.
Yeah, I don't think you're to blame. Is there a specific joke from that set that you that stands out in your memory that you wrote or that you were really happy with?
I wrote a joke about Trump owns a beauty pageant which will help Republicans in selecting their next vice presidential candidate because Sarah Palin had been. And I wrote a one about he's sitting at the fox table and there's a fox on top of his head. More than that, I was a good producer in that Alex Bays had written a joke that Trump has a great relationship with the blacks. And if I assume that's true, if by blacks you mean a white family.
Yeah.
And Seth had cut it. And I was like, it was like not long before the ceremony. I was like, hey, where's that joke? And he's like, I cut it. And I was like, put it in. You got to put it in. He's like, are you sure? And I was like, I'm positive.
And it killed?
So it killed and like Obama loved it.
Yeah, that's what you want.
Yeah, that's how those shows go. If you get the main guy, then you'll get everybody.
Donald Trump owns the Miss USA pageant, which is great for Republicans because it will streamline their search for a vice president. Donald Trump said recently he has a great relationship with the blacks, though unless the blacks are a family of white people, I bet he's mistaken.
Do you have a story or memory from your career that makes you laugh now but really was not funny when it happened?
I was doing a TV show and the guy went to Africa.
Perfect.
Can you believe it?
Well, I like that it makes you laugh now, or I don't know if it does, but...
Oh, I'm lying about that.
Yeah.
Still makes me tear up.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Do you have a story about the first time you met one of your comedy heroes, someone you really looked up to in comedy, maybe from, you know, another generation or someone you met along the way that it meant a lot to you to meet them and what it was like?
Meeting Eddie Murphy is still probably the high point of people I've met. Like when I met Obama the night of the Correspondents' Dinner, I was significantly less nervous because I'd met Eddie. Like that, he was my Obama. And funnily enough, Eddie has a picture in his house of him meeting Obama. And guess who looks more nervous?
I can imagine.
Obama.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Obama. Because you know, Eddie was in...
Because he's Eddie Murphy.
Yep. And Obama was probably in college when 48 Hours came out. Like, you know, so... pretty means a lot to a lot of us.
And finally, I like to give my guests a chance to shout out something that's making them laugh right now. Is there anything that you've seen recently, a comedian, a show, anything that made you laugh that you want to give a shout out to?
There's a comedian in LA named Fahim Anwar who's really funny. He's one of my faves, like a great, he used to open for me on the road and great, really good writer, really good performer. And there's a girl named Casey Shornima who opened for me in Dallas. And then she gave me a tag, actually. So right there. She gave me the Proud Boys tag. The Proud Boys, like the I say Proud Boys reference. And then that led to me taking the glasses off. So it was like very helpful. And then I ended up recommending her to Jost, and now she writes for Update on Silent Lab.
Nice. Yeah. Very cool.
So she's really funny. Yeah. And she's a really good comic. That's the power of tags, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah. Tag will get you everywhere.
Give a man a tag and you'll fish for a lifetime.
Thank you, man, so much. This was really great. And I really, really enjoyed your special. And yeah, I think people are going to dig it.
I hope so, man. Good talking to you, bro.
Okay, thanks again to Neil Brennan for being my guest on this week's show. His new stand-up special, Blocks, is streaming now on Netflix, where you can also find his previous special, Three Mics. I highly recommend checking both of them out if you haven't gotten a chance to yet. And you can get tickets for his just-announced brand new Neil tour at neilbrennan.com. If you want to support The Last Laugh, please help us out by leaving a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. We want as many people to hear this show as possible, and you can help by spreading the word and sharing it with your friends. You can find me on Twitter at Matt Wilstein and at thedailybeast.com. And if you're not already, please follow at Last Laugh Pod on Instagram, where you can see photos and videos from all of our episodes and see who is coming up next week on the show. The Last Laugh is distributed by Acast for The Daily Beast, with audio production by Jesse Cannon. Our theme music is by Claude, who you can find on Instagram at claude.mp3. You can find this show every week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And as always, you can find show notes and highlights from each episode on thedailybeast.com. See you next week.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.